little bit of time to make sure we're all on the same page. And we will open a work session on SDR 23. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the dash 3 to SDR 23. And as I described the other day, I believe that if we're going to have a shot at passing this with the voters, we need to keep this as clean as possible, although my version of clean may be a little different than Representative Mannix, somewhat clean. But I think politically clean, we need to make sure that when the voters vote on this, there is no argument for self-serving in this. And by this amendment, we are taking out the anybody that's currently or has currently served in the legislature under term limits. So I just believe that this helps make, we're going to pass this with the voters, we're going to have to make this acceptable to them and take the argument away that we're somehow self-serving ourselves with this. So with that, I'd offer the dash 3 amendments into the bill.
Representative
Mack. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I respectfully disagree with the dash 3 amendments. I don't see anything self-serving here. I think we're serving the people. We're giving them an opportunity to take a look at what definition of term limits they'd like to have. My problem is that in this effort to avoid the appearance of being self-serving, we actually complicate the understanding of what the measure is all about. I mentioned parenthetically that in the past I've received letters from people when there are things going on the ballot where you're putting provisions into the Constitution, and they often look at this language and get confused. Even as HJR-4, which just passed the House, was being considered, and people read that resolution, some people thought we were doing something about women's property rights under marriage, when all we were doing was, that was in current constitutional language, but it was in there, and then they saw it, and they got confused. I got letters about that, saying, what are you doing about women's property rights? Well, the answer is nothing. That's already in the Constitution. In this case, I think people reading this will get confused about the applicability. I also think that there should be no problem just saying in a universal sense that we're talking 12 years mix or match. In terms of that, this amendment as well as the SGR 23 generally, I'll tell you, I'm amazed the number of people in my district who think that because I stepped down that I get a fresh shot of term limits because they think it's only a term limitation, but if you step down, you get a fresh start. And I'm talking about people who pay attention to public affairs, and they're just amazed. When you add complications, you make it harder for folks to understand things. I think that I respectfully disagree with the more complicated amendment. Put it that way.
Okay. Good discussion. What else? Quick call rule.
Richard Byer?
No.
Edwin?
No.
Edwards?
Aye.
Gardner? Aye. Mannix?
No.
Guard?
Aye.
Chair Simmons? No. The motion not having received the majority of the card failed.
Mr. Chairman.
Let's do Mannix.
I move the dash 5 amendment to SDR 23. May I explain?
Yes.
The dash 5 amendment simply set this for a vote in November 1999 for House Bill 2354, which is setting up a special election for other purposes. I think it's a good idea to get this out to the voters, and they'll be looking at victims' rights, HGRs, assuming that they continue their passage through the Senate, and this will give them some other things to look at the same time.
The discussion on the dash 5 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I have some real reservations about putting it on the 99 ballot. My personal opinion, I believe the 2000 ballot would be more appropriate. So I'll object.
Any discussion? Representative Edwards.
Well, I'm going to disagree again with my colleagues to my right. Again, my concern is if we want to make this pass, this, again, puts a big target on this, which is now we're allowing this to pass at a time, which will then benefit some people in this body right now. And I guess I'm trying to make it politically as clean as possible for voters. This is, I believe, a target, so I'm not going to support this today.
Please call the roll. Dash 5, amendment to SCR 23.
Meyer?
Aye.
Kavanaugh?
No.
Edwards?
Nope.
Gardner?
No.
Mann?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Aye. Having received the required majority, SCR 5, the dash 5 amendments to SCR 23 are adopted. Mm-hmm. Representative Manning.
I move SCR 23 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, so there's a motion. Let's move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Representative Manning.
While I respect the difference of opinion with my colleagues as to when this ought to be voted on, I think now we have the substance of the matter in front of us, and I'd encourage an aye vote so we can give the voters a chance to take a look at this issue and decide for themselves how they feel about it. Thank you.
Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I will be voting no on this. My colleague, Representative Edwards, I believe in disturbing notice of a minority report. I will be joining on that minority report just as a courtesy to my colleagues. I'll be voting no on the minority report and no on the majority report on the floor.
I don't know if that helps or hurts you.
Representative Gardner.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I've never been a fan of term limits. I believe this is just a minor adjustment to term limits. Although I radically disagree with putting it on the November 99 ballot, I will support the motion today, but I will certainly be thinking it over, and that's not necessarily a guarantee of a yes vote on the floor.
Thank you. Mr. Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not real excited about having this go out on the ballot. I'll be a courtesy yes to get it on the floor, but I sure noticed that I was perhaps changing my mind.
President Mannix.
Why, I'm sorry, I deferred Representative Beyer. I think he had a chance first.
President Beyer.
Well, if anybody else will explain the vote, I'm going to explain my enthusiastic yes vote, and I will be an enthusiastic yes on the floor. And if anyone wants to come after me, I have always had a term limit. I opposed it in 92 in the past, and I oppose it today. And every time you run for election, that's a term limit. If the voters don't like it, they'll throw the scandal out. And as I said before, I think we recognize each one is probably hated in 59 other districts, but we are still elected in one, so there's always an argument, you know, for that. So I think it's good it's time to give it back to the voters and have the Oregon voters have a chance to vote on a term limit bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I was here as a representative when term limits was proposed. I was here when it was passed. And I have to hear all but one term since then. And we will always be nervous about, some of us, about taking this issue to the voters because we're concerned about it looking self-serving and all this. But let's flash back and remember, the voters never had a chance to have a choice as to what kind of term limits they would have as the Oregon legislators. They had an up or down vote on a measure that was basically aimed at Congress, and the legislature was mentioned as an afterthought, and I say that from hands-on experience because I was out there debating this measure, and I remember twice challenging the proponents when I stood up in response saying, now you folks are going to get a rebuttal, and when you come up on rebuttal, will you please tell this audience why we need term limits for the Oregon legislature? And then they stood up, and during rebuttal, they talked about Congress. This gives Oregon voters a chance to take a look at a clean measure as to what I call mix and match 12 years term limits for the Oregon legislature, a nice clean shot at it. It empowers them to make a further determination as to what kind of term limits they want to have for Oregon legislators. It's neither more nor less than that. I've heard some people say that this is an insult to the voters or this is a denigration of the voters. Hardly. We're going back and saying, here's another version, slightly altered, that deals with the internal problems of the two branches of, or the two bodies of the legislature and tries to make things work in a little more synchronicity. And would you please consider it? That's what it does. And to me, it's a very mild, moderate, temperate approach to the voters. And yes, I joined Representative Beyer in enthusiastically supporting the referral.
Thank you very much, colleagues. I appreciate all your comments. I do believe But this bill will offer the people of Oregon a choice on what kind of term limits they want to have in place for their elected officials.
Okay.
I think the current term limits that we have in place do transfer influence from the elected members of the legislature in the House to the lobby, to the staff, and to the Senate. As much as I appreciate our good colleagues in the Senate, we have seen the more complex and more contentious issues have started over there this session. And that's not for, and it's not without reason that that is beginning to happen. And in order to keep the House as a co-equal partner in this process that we all are here voluntarily participating in, I think it behooves us to offer to the voters an opportunity to choose on a term limit bill that does keep pace with the 12 years they put in place and for the adoption. So with that, I would clerk, please call the roll.
Meyer.
Aye.
Devlin.
No.
Edwards.
No, and for possible notice of minority report.
Gardner.
Yeah.
Manish.
Aye.
Woodard.
Aye.
Griffin.
Aye. And the bill goes before the House for due pass and recommendation.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Two of the Democratic members, I believe, now for a leadership meeting. It's a courtesy to the chair and our guys not to find disagreements at all. If 404 comes up for a re-vote while we're gone, it is the intent of the two members that we have to launch a minority report on 404.
Well, I would like to dispense with that.
You're right.
If possible, we could just do it right now. So.
Okay.
Bring it back. Yeah. And we need to make some adjustments to that. So we will open a... We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 404. Colleagues that have not yet been dropped at the desk. And what I would like is to ask for the extension of rules for reconsidering the vote by which we passed out Central 404.
So moved.
So moved. Okay. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so moved. I'd ask for a that we reconsider the vote by which we passed out Central 404. So moves are moves that we reconsider the vote. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Now we have some amendments before us today. Colleagues, the amendments are not out of LC yet, so we will have to come back. It deals with Section 4 in an added section. So changing the Class B misdemeanor to a Class A that consists of other wildlife laws. And we will finish this up then tomorrow. And we can take care of any motions at that point. And we'll close the work session before 4. Representative Gardner, if you go directly to 2989, you have some questions on that?
Yes, I do.
We'll open a work session on 2989.
Thank you. Cooking up a bunch of food.
We are in work session on 89. Mr. Keith, would you please bring us up to speed with what we're doing?
Right, so members of the committee, you have received from me a set of A3 amendments, a set of A4 amendments, and today we bring you the A5 amendments. Covering those earlier versions with a 5 or 6 bulleted item indicating what the amendments do. The statement of what the amendments do does not change even as the amendment number changes. What you have today is the hand-engrossed version and the LC version of the A5 amendment. Basically, what is happening here is that statement of policy intent has been added to the bill. The membership of the Statewide Workforce Investment Board has been changed. It used to be that to do business, the Workforce Investment Boards had to have 51% of the members present being business representatives. That has been changed to 25%. The content of the statewide board has been changed. That's the report that the governor sends to, that is sent by the board to the governor and to the legislature. The goals that were in the original bill have been changed somewhat. They're still goal-oriented, but some of the specificity as to numbers have been deleted. Duties have been added to the statewide investment board. Primarily, these are duties having to do with looking to make it work better and easier and faster and better. In the prior versions, each county and the city of Portland were their own local workforce investment area. That has been changed. With these amendments, only the governor can establish a workforce investment area. That could be a county, it could be the city of Portland, and there can be combinations thereof. And I believe that's the effect of the amendments.
Mr. Chair.
President Byer.
15 started. I move A5 amendments into House Bill 2989.
Calling for a motion before us to move the A5 amendments into House Bill 2989.
Mr. Chair.
Justin Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having been through this bill through two committees now,
this bill has only been in this committee.
Or I two different versions. Two different committees. I understand, Greg. I do have a series of questions of either Representative Byer or Mr. Putnam, whichever works. And if I could just start with, basically, I just want to know if there's anything in this bill that imposes the work-first philosophy on all workforce participants, such as UI participants, either attached or job attached, or throughout all of the other participants, or is it consistent with the federal act?
I know the answer. The answer is no, it does not.
Okay. It's just totally consistent with the federal act. Then.
I am not that conversant with the federal act, but given what I think the intent of your question is, I think the correct answer is yes.
Okay. On the reference to the newly created state board would not prevent the governor from retaining current members of the workforce advisory committee that have already been confirmed by the Senate, right?
There's no provision to get rid of any members by name, position, or organization.
Could use the current board that's in place.
That's my understanding, Mr.
Chair. I think we need to clarify that. We can use the current board members who are in place, but they would have to be appointed to the new board and be confirmed by the Senate.
Right, but in the old bill, it said that it could not be members of the advisory in the original version, I remember, from another committee.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would like to point out that this bill is 2989, and there's no other bill that's dealing with...
it was. Okay. All right. The reference to the term public assistance does not include UI participants. In the definition of public assistance.
I don't believe it does. I know that elsewhere in the statute there is a definition of public assistance, and to my knowledge, it never has included UI.
But the definition is consistent with the federal act that way?
It's my belief it is, yes, sir.
And doesn't go beyond that point?
Not to my knowledge.
So basically nothing in this bill intended to change the priorities of federal law relating to public assistance for low-income individuals receiving intensive and training services.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, a couple places towards the end of the bill, specific language is used to the extent it's consistent with the federal act. And that's just sort of a theme that runs through the bill. You see several references to the federal act.
Okay. Well, having just seen the Dash 5 amendments, it's...
What? Have a half hour head start on you.
Okay. Goodness. Well, so nothing in the bill would change the current law or rule that UI claimants need only actively look for suitable work to maintain benefit eligibility?
I'd like to find, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, the exact statements on that. Okay, it's taking just a second to do that. If you would look, Representative Gardner, on page 7, near the top, on line, whole line 41, that's of the A in growth.
Page 7 where?
The hand in growth. Page 7 on line 41, near the top of the page.
Yeah.
Notice that it should provide timely listing of all job opportunities consistent with statute or rule. And so there is no... it doesn't matter if you're subsidized or unsubsidized, and it has to be consistent with statute or rule. And I believe the intent there was to allow the non-referral of work-attached persons.
Okay. Just a couple more.
nothing
in the bill makes subsidized employment a core service. I
don't know the answer to that. Repeat the answer, do we?
Okay. Could we bring up the governor, or Ms. Price Riley, just to help along with this? Just a couple more questions.
Okay. Introduce yourself for the record.
Kim Price-Holly with the Governor's Office of Education and Workforce Policy. My read is that it does not make it a closer.
Okay. Sure. Just a couple more.
Okay, go ahead.
Nothing in the bill sets up another funding stream for unemployment insurance claimants under the Jobs Plus program, does it?
I believe there's no reference to the Jobs Plus program in it.
Okay. There was original references there. Okay.
No, not in this one.
I'm sorry. I was in the still going back to the other committee.
Mr. Chair, if Representative Gardner wants to put on the record some things that aren't in this bill, he's more than happy if he'd like to see them in this bill.
Could be fine. Okay. Just one other last question. Nothing in this section precludes the governor from naming another agency as an interim lead if he, in consultation with the board, decides it's appropriate.
That's correct.
Okay. And nothing in the bill expands the eligibility requirement in any way on, well, you know, that's just, never mind. That's a subsidized job from the already went through.
Your questions are answered?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, it is the Kumbaya Amendment.
Well, I think they are. That's certainly the impression that I have, Mr. Manning.
Mr. Chair, would you like to, there's a representative of the counties here, and we just had a representative from the governor's workforce and policy office or something like that, if you'd like to have them offer there.
I think head nods would be sufficient. Okay.
Okay.
Yes. And Representative Starr?
Thank you. That's to represent by our question. If you tell me 50 words or less, why we need this bill.
Ooh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, we need this bill to set our state workforce board and to give them guidelines as to what we as the legislature would like them to do.
Okay. Like, currently they're not doing what we want them to do, or?
Mr. Chair, currently we have a workforce board that does not meet the Federal Act requirements.
Okay. We are in work session. We have a motion before us. If questions are answered and if members of the committee are satisfied, is there further discussion? The motion is to adopt the A5 amendment. And please call the roll.
Meyer.
Aye.
Chairman.
Excuse.
Edward.
Excuse.
Gardner.
Aye.
Manis.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
And the A5 amendments are adopted.
Sure. I move House Bill 2989-4 as amended with a DFAP recommendation.
Colleagues, the motion before us to move the bill as amended to the floor of the DFAP recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Byron will be the carrier.
I would be glad to be the carrier.
And that closes the work session on House preparing
My career is over.
I'm going to miss the speed to be up here.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to do that ballot title one?
I would like to do the ballot title, and I'd like to at least have a discussion of...
I can fill something in on that, too.
Okay.
Are we on that now?
Yeah, we will open a public hearing on
4:15.
Although I believe there's no one signed up.
Want to recess for 4 minutes to make it legal?
Well, we can go into work session. There's open a work session on 35-37.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Manic.
The listing is for public hearing and possible work session at 4:15.
Then we will reset at 4:15.
Can I
get these people to call them? No. This is my little piece, isn't it? Let's talk about it some, okay?
Yeah.
We are in, I will open a public hearing on HB 3537, and we have the dash one amendment before us. Janet, can you give us an overview here?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The dash one amendments to House Bill 3537 would specify what the ballot title would be if Senate Joint Resolution 23, the term limit measure, is referred to the people. As the dash one amendments are written, the top of page 2 it specifies that the procedure for review of the ballot title shall be as provided in ORS 250085, which offers anyone a chance to object to a ballot title and go through a process with the Attorney General's office, and then even vote to get that ballot title changed. My understanding, you have the option of saying that 250085 does not apply to the ballot title creator. So there's an option if you want to do that.
So we have the option of striking Section 2, should we choose to do so.
And if you start Section 2, you might want to add a section that says ORS 250-085 shall not apply to this ballot title.
Yes. As I understood the amendment as presented to us, you would not have a draft ballot title prepared by the Attorney General because this would be the ballot title. But the Secretary of State would establish a rule for people to have a deadline to file a petition to the Supreme Court, and you could still have a petition for Supreme Court review, but that you, if I had understood it, the way I read it was that you don't have any involvement by the Attorney General in drafting a ballot plan.
Okay.
Because there are, I've dealt with several bills on this, and there are two avenues you can follow. One avenue is this becomes a draft ballot title, and actually it becomes a ballot title, and you don't have the Attorney General drafting one. And the second avenue is you go a step further and you say, and by the way, there won't even be Supreme Court review of the ballot title. Now, the governor has generally indicated as a matter of policy that he will veto bills that eliminate Supreme Court review of a ballot title, but he will not automatically veto bills that establish the ballot title itself. He's made the argument that he would like to, any citizen to have a chance to at least go to court once to challenge the ballot title. So I'd certainly encourage us not to come up with another amendment that eliminates Supreme Court review. But when the Supreme Court reviews it under this process, this is treated as the equivalent of an Attorney General ballot title, which as long as it's, I don't know the exact legal standard, but reasonably, a reasonable statement of what this ballot measure is about, they're not going to rewrite it. It's only if they find that it goes beyond the pale that they go into it and play with it, so to speak. So it's good for the legislature to have a bill like this establishing a ballot title. But if I understood the earlier explanation, it might have been that the effect that this is just a draft that the Attorney General still could look it over. Did I misunderstand that?
No, Mr. Chair, I think that you're right, Mr. Smith, and then except it would be the Supreme Court review.
If I may then, Mr. Chairman, I think the Dash 1 approach is the best approach because it certainly is sensitive to the governor's concern about if there's not an emergency type of election, which this is not, this is a referral for November, there's still a few months left, that he likes letting the Supreme Court at least have a look at it. But we do come out of the starting gate with a ballot title in place, and that's, in effect, presumably the ballot title that will be used unless someone shows the Supreme Court that it really is wrong, which, looking at this amendment, these Dashian amendments clearly is not wrong. It's a nice ballot title.
Yes, sir. Representative Breyer?
I'm curious as to the reading of the result of the no vote, specifically on line 15 of the amendment, when it reads, as representative, senator, and in Oregon legislator. I just say, sure. That doesn't read so well. I don't know if that ballot title speaks. It is kind of choppy. And I think we had a bill that dealt with that this session and that allowed for more words in these titles and donations and such.
Why do we need representatives?
Because currently, as a representative, you can serve 3 terms. As a senator, you can serve 2 terms. Or in Northern Legislature, you can serve 12 years. And so I think that's the reason that's included here, because it is different for each. Do we have a motion moving the amendments yet?
We're still in public hearing.
Oh, okay.
But anyone want to testify on the ballot title? We'll be in the doors today.
We're supposed to
go to public hearing and go to a work session on House 3537. You might give a call up.
Yeah,
and have them come down.
Okay.
During the minority office? The Democratic office?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if we're close to discussion, I would move the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. So a motion colleagues to move the Dash 1 amendment.
If I may, for the record, Mr. Chairman.
Representative May.
I did have a conversation with Representative Edwards a little earlier off the record, and I indicated to him that I know he's offering a minority report on the ballot measure itself, that should that minority report be adopted by the House, then as this goes over to the Senate would necessarily amend the ballot title to conform to the minority report, and so that in terms of efficiency, it's not necessary to also do a minority report on the ballot title, that issue can be addressed, and it would be of necessity addressed in the Senate. It does just take a little bit of time, so I just mentioned that in a conversation with Representative Edwards, and I thought I'd just put that on the record.
Thank you for doing that. I
actually looking at this, I'm not sure how much you would modify it, frankly, but that would be another discussion.
Okay.
So I'm not going to vote. I will support this.
And before you came in, Representative Edwards, we did have a discussion about the Supreme Court review, about review of the ballot title, and but we did not debate it in depth. We have several options. We can allow a ballot title that cannot be reviewed, or we can provide the language here that does allow for review.
The language in the Dash 1 amendment does allow Supreme Court review, and I had mentioned earlier that the governor has indicated as a policy preference, unless there's an emergency, which there is not right now, that he would be opposed to eliminating Supreme Court review. I've heard that from his representative. But he's not, as a policy matter, indisposed in terms of disposed against a ballot title that is subject to Supreme Court review. I'm not saying that there's a guarantee that he would sign this. I'm just saying that this process comports with his philosophy.
Further discussion? If they're coming, we will just stand at ease until they arrive. We will come back to order. We have a ballot title before us for Senate Joint Resolution 23. If it is referred to the people by the 70th legislative assembly, which is the step of the legislature. And this is a gut and stuff of House Bill 3537. Makes it a ballot title bill. I have a motion before us to move it to the floor as it would be.
Let's say we have actually one move the amendment.
Right, move the amendment to the bill. We were patiently waiting. Okay. Discussion? Okay. Is there any objection to the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3537? Okay. Hearing none, please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3537 as amended before the DPAS recommendation.
Okay. Part of the motion for us to move House Bill 3537 to the floor of the House for the DPAS recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mayor.
I'll just mention to the benefit of the two colleagues who've arrived that we've had a little colloquy with Representative Edwards. If there's a minority report to the HDR itself and it's
SDR.
Excuse me, SDR, and it's amended, if that had any impact on the ballot title, then the ballot title bill of necessity, which is a House bill, would be amended in the Senate so that there's no need to worry about a minority report on the ballot title at this point. It's the SDR itself, which would be the key point, because you couldn't have an inconsistent House bill anyway.
Why start now? I'm just kidding.
What's the devil?
Mr. Chairman, I will be voting no and serving notice of a minority report. I will not be carrying the minority report. Representative Gardner, who will be the second, and I will be carrying the minority report. It's not the ballot title date that we are interested in. It's the relating clause.
Oh. Yes, Mr. Chair.
But the content of the original bill will be
in addition.
In addition.
Primary elections and such?
It could be possible.
Okay. You're not to miss an opportunity. Okay. However, there may be a germane once we get, if it is amended with the -1, it may be a germaneness problem. I don't know.
Well, we can work on that.
Okay. Further discussion. Hearing none, would you please call the roll?
Tim Geyer.
Aye.
Devlin.
No.
Edwards.
Aye.
Gardner.
No.
Maddox.
Aye.
Starr.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye. And HB 3537, as amended, is amended.
Mr. Chair,
we amended it and moved it to the floor. So.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, there's a notice of intent of a possible minority report.
And it's early before 5 o'clock. We had half an hour.
I get ahead of the game.
The motion carries. The bill goes before the House. The Duke House recommendation. And I will be the carrier. All right, or fine. You the carrier. That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Who's the carrier on the SJR?
I may carry that, or I may ask for one of the others to carry the SJR.
I can carry the
SJR. Didn't you vote no on the SJR?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a problem.
But let's go on to the last item on our agenda today. We'll open a close the work session on 3537 and open a public hearing on HJR 67. Janet, please give us an overview, and we may need to pay close attention here because it's a rather complex issue has to do with redistricting. So if you can give us the background of the whole situation, how the problems surface. Last time redistricting was done by the legislature, and how these are solutions to make problems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we are discussing the -1 amendments, not the original bill. And the -1 amendments replace the original bill. Actually, the changes that are in HR 67 were among some changes that were introduced in 1993, right after the 1991 round of redistricting by the Senate interim government operations committee. It was SJR 3 at the time in the 93 session, but that legislation passed the Senate but failed to pass the House. It did have an additional provision in it that's not in what you see today to make the Secretary of State a fallback if the legislature fails to enact a plan for congressional redistricting, but that provision has been taken out of this measure. It might have been more controversial if it was part of this measure. And this is almost a housekeeping measure, but there are some policy changes for that you'll probably want to consider them and maybe not want to do all the pieces of the amendment. The first change you'll notice is that it deletes the term regular so that the legislature could adopt a redistricting plan in a special session, but it maintains the July 1st, which will be 2001 for the next redistricting round. It maintains that July 1st deadline. This probably wouldn't be necessary because the legislature would be in session through July 1st in most years, but if the legislature did adjourn early, they could come back in special session to adopt the redistricting plan by the July 1st deadline. This would also apply if the legislature did go to the annual session plan as proposed currently, because the 120-day session would not take you through the July 1st. It would take you through about the first week of May, and that would shorten the amount of time you have to redistrict. It might be helpful to have out when you're looking at this measure that timeline that's at your place. It's a flow chart of the redistricting timeline. The legislature has to receive from the federal government their members by April 1st in 2001. Last 1991, they did receive them in March, but the deadline that the federal government has is April 1st, so you can't really count on having population numbers until that, until the April 1st date. The next change in the, there are no changes to dates or deadlines if the legislature does enact a claim, and that's at the top of page 2, those dates have not changed. So this is if the legislature enacts a plan, and so following the left column of the flowchart, there aren't any changes in the left-hand column if the legislature does adopt a plan. The changes begin on the bottom of page 2, excuse me, if the legislature fails to adopt a plan. And so those affect the column, the right column of the existing flowchart. And the first change is that the Secretary of State's office is given 2 additional weeks from August 15th is the current deadline to submit a plan, and that's changed to September 1st. So if the legislature fails to enact a plan on July 1st, currently the Secretary of State, and this did happen in 1991, the Secretary of State only had 6 weeks to adopt a full plan. And the Secretary of State doesn't know until July 1st that they're going to be in that position. So they have to be able to staff up, acquire equipment, and get up to speed with the redistricting process, and they only have the 6 weeks in which to do that and adopt the plan. The Secretary of State also is required in the Constitution to have a public hearing. In 1991, the Secretary of State had at least 6 locations around the state, and I think had 13 public hearings. Again, that's a lot to try to do in the 6-week period, and the amendment would make that give them an additional 2 weeks to do that. The Supreme Court date change for when a person has to submit an objection to the plan is also pushed back by 2 weeks, and that's the next change in the measure.
Question,
yes.
Just an honor to you, Mr. Chairman.
Go right ahead. Indulge yourself.
Since this is a constitutional amendment,
mm-hmm.
we could put in here a 3-5 requirement for approval in the Washington Senate for redistricting plans, you know?
I don't think that amendment would succeed in the committee.
Oh.
I don't think you'd want it. Mr. Chair, since this is a lot of effect on the Secretary of State's office, has the Secretary of State's office been contacted about that to have a position?
This is my first, I don't know how I'm moving this today.
Okay.
I wanted to bring this up for discussion and submit ourselves to this issue, and then we can make a decision about whether or not we want to proceed down this road, and we'll certainly give it up for a public hearing again, and perhaps it'd be appropriate to invite them to come up and testify.
They are aware of that resolution and support that.
Given the effects of term limits, they would be the only ones that have been here until this was done. So.
But they would not be the same Secretary of State next time.
Sure.
And what it does do is shorten, because you'll see toward the end that the other effect of the measure is to have the operative date 2 weeks earlier of the plan. Again, on the right-hand column, if the legislature does not enact a plan, you follow through all the steps, and they did that in 1991, the plan does not become effective until December 15th. And that doesn't give the county clerks around the state very much time to redraw precinct lines, which they have to do after the new districts are drawn, to redraw precinct lines, or for candidates to know the new districts. So that's why the change in the amendment would make that date December 1st. So we give 2 more weeks to redraw precinct lines and 2 more weeks for candidates to understand what the new districts are going to be before the March 1st, March filing deadline. But the result of that is that the Secretary of State, one time period that the Secretary of State does have is shortened by 2 weeks, but that is for them to resubmit a plan at the Supreme Court directs them to make corrections. They have, instead of 4 weeks, they have 2 weeks on that resubmission. And the Secretary of State does understand that. And talking to the staff that went through this last time in 1991, that is not as critical because the Supreme Court directs them exactly what they're supposed to do, and they can't do anything but that, according to the Constitution. So that 2 weeks was determined to be sufficient for that resubmission of the claim.
Manic?
I'm sorry, I thought this was finished.
We've been kind of jumping in here.
All right. Well, my only observation would be that I see that Ray Phelps is here, and I'm sure that he could be a key commentator if there's a concern, and I'll welcome hearing from him at some point as to the technical aspects, and certainly the Secretary of State's office may have some comments for us. But I'm pleased to see that we're approaching some of these deficiencies that I call it in the process, and I'm pleased that this is brought forward. Having been through the resistance process, I can tell you that it's good. And if we can put a few appropriate fences up at the zoo so the animals aren't running amok, which this bill does, it's a good idea. Thank you. This has nothing to do with canned hops, I was just saying.
Yes. You got a dozen.
I can say before, too.
The changes that begin in bold on page 4 of the amendment, again, talking about the December 15th, or if the legislature enacts a plan, it could be as early as September 1st when the plan becomes effective. The Constitution says that those are the operative dates for the new district plan. The problem is that they become operative, according to the Attorney General's office, even for sitting legislators that have another year left. They may, for House members, another year left, and for Senate members, another 3 years left of their term. If this language was changed so that the operative date was only for the next election and purpose of nominating and electing the legislator for the next session, but the old district lines stay in place for the remainder of the term of our legislators, it would be more clear, and we wouldn't have to assign representatives to the new district for the remainder of their term. And this did happen during the 91 redistricting. Legislators had to be assigned to new districts. This will always happen. Senators that are holdover senators and that are midterm will always have to be assigned to new districts under the redistricting plan. But this avoids all having representatives have to be assigned to new districts.
Does that leave open opportunities for some citizens out there to be unrepresented if the line gets drawn a certain way?
They would be represented by their current sitting representative.
What I'm saying is if the current line is in effect for the sitting, let's say, senator, that's 3 terms, 3 years left. Mm-hmm. We're sitting there, we'd have to change, and then the line gets drawn, and so it doesn't affect him, but takes part of his district into someone else's. But does that saying is there an opportunity that somebody wouldn't have a senator representing them?
I don't believe that this change, Representative Starr, would make any difference in that. I think there could be a problem from holdover senators, and that case would come up from the current Constitution or under this change, that there could be individuals who don't vote for a senator. And that did happen after the people that don't get to vote for a senator when they would have under the old district plan. They're always represented by someone, but they wouldn't get to vote on schedule for a senator because of the new district plan.
And that's like 6 years to vote again.
And that was a challenge. The Republican Party did challenge the plan in 91 on that basis, but it was not successful.
It would only be an additional 2 years, though, to vote again, not 6 years.
Right.
We've been 6 years since the previous voting.
Yes, I think that's right. But I don't think that this would cause that to happen. This change.
Okay.
And it also stipulates that if a vacancy occurs, that the vacancy would be filled from the district to which the senator, it takes care of vacancies in that case where you're still representing an old district but running from a new district. The vacancy would be filled from the old district during that year. This also stipulates how many number of signatures that are required for a recall position or a holdover senator following the apportionment that's not covered in the Constitution currently. And finally, there is an outdated provision of the Constitution that disallows dividing counties when creating senatorial districts. It used to be that all Senate districts had to be created from whole counties. But that's already been found to be unconstitutional because of the two court cases, because of equal representation and equal population districts. So that's an outdated provision that's just deleted and eliminated in the measure.
Sure.
This is there.
Question, where is that? Alicia might have no.
That's important now, too. So. I'm not sure if I'm not seeing it myself.
Yeah, that's kind of a naive question here, but does reapportionment also affect congressional districting as well? So this really does speak largely to the legislative districts. Is that, it seems to me, those reading to this.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the Constitution only speaks to legislative redistricting and creates deadlines for legislative redistricting. There are not similar provisions for congressional redistricting. That was another provision that was in the 93 proposed legislation that did not pass the House, was to create similar set up and deadlines and fall back to the Secretary of State for congressional redistricting. What has to happen now is that if the legislature, there's no July 1st deadline, but if the legislature fails to enact a plan, someone has to sue in federal court to say that the old plan is no longer fair, and then the court can instruct the legislature to do something about it, or draft a plan, or ask the Secretary of State to document it, and not be very afraid that it's up to the court.
Well, I guess you know a little bit more about what the arguments are against trying to set this up. I mean, you know why it failed in 93, is it? It is too empowering of the Secretary of State. I don't know the argument, but it seems like if it's good for the goose, it might be good for the gander in this case. In some ways, you're trying to create more order. You know, for, I don't know. This is all in this territory for me.
Does our Oregon Constitution have, or we do have the power to do something on the federal level?
The statute of the legislature, instructs the legislature to do redistricting for the
Mr. Chair, I believe staff is correct, and that the difference is that the fallback position at the federal level is not through the state, it is through the federal court. And that is the difference. Because the legislature has the authority, and that my knowledge, to do it if they come to agreement. If they don't, at the state level, the fallback is the Secretary of State, and then the Oregon Supreme Court. On the U.S. level, it is the federal court that has the fallback authority to do this.
Okay.
does this, the amending, as we're doing here, is not about the appointment, but just the apportioning, is that, does this lend itself, not the fallback, but just the process somehow lend itself also to the federal side that we should consider? I mean, this is just talking about the legislative assembly and lines there. I'm throwing that out to the staff committee. I mean, the fallback I can see. Is that you're saying, Roger, that that's constitutional, or is that federal law?
Federal law, I believe, because we're fallback on the federal representative bar.
You would challenge based on that this district.
The current district no longer is up.
Equal population.
Right. Equal population is the Constitution. Okay. Well, I'll give you a few days, colleagues, to digest, and we'll visit. We can visit around, and we can each other on the floor or whatever, and we can get back and ask the officer 6 minutes and testify if that would be appropriate, and it may be.
Yeah.
And anyone else who wishes to testify, we'll get it up for public hearing again. And
this is such a final ballot, is it going?
We may have some choices on that.
Did you like to look over
there? Mr. Phelps, let's come up and talk. We are in public hearing.
Somebody who has a little experience with the enforcement, I think.
And it makes you wonder. Except I have 6 children also, so maybe you don't wonder. My name's Craig Phelps. I live in Lake Oswego. And I did the reapportionment of the Secretary of State's office in 1981 because of a default. And I did the reapportionment in 1991 as a staff person on the Speaker's staff. And one of the things you don't want to do is you don't want to get the federal congressional and the state legislative entangled. They should stand alone and be alone. When you do the congressional, your standard for deviation is very, very minimal, if any at all. It's almost an arithmetic perfection. You got to get within 1 or 2 people. With regard to legislative, however, you have a lot more latitude to have a difference in population in some of the legislative districts because of historical significance. For example, the historical significance we implanted in 1981 is the Cascades. That's why it's been always difficult to get across the Cascades. That's a very historical boundary. And frankly, if you bring part of a legislative district across the Cascades with a majority in eastern or central Oregon, those people are written off, those on the west side of the mountain. So we've always tried to keep that as historical significance. And there's Indians, and I mean, there's a whole lot of historically significant, and what that all leads up to is you can have as much as a deviation of 10 or 15% between the highest and lowest populated districts. And so you don't really want to get the congressional embroiled. The other thing is it's been my understanding, and I stand to be corrected by a professional person, but I'll bet I'm right, is in the federal district court has jurisdiction. So we can go through a Secretary of State exercise and or a Supreme Court exercise. It makes no difference. You're going to be into the federal district court. They have the jurisdiction. But one of the significant elements you should bear in mind is if you do go into the federal district court, you bring with you the body of information that led to either the impasse or the disparity. I think it would be much more important for the legislature's historical and public process to be that body of information rather than obscure or obliterated by having intermittent sequences beyond the legislature. At that point, your history goes away. And I think you want that history in place. You know, in other words, what did we do and why did we do it? So those are a couple of reasons why I don't think you want to mess with the congressional thing in this vehicle, just as an observation. And the other thing about reapportionment, and this may sound a little flippant, but it truly isn't. Reapportionment is not a science. It's an art. There's no right answer. It's just whatever the courts either accept or nobody challenges. So don't try to be, you know, so careful here. The process is like any piece of legislation. It has its highs and it has its lows. So
Mr. Phelps, what we have here is an HCR that would change process.
Right.
Should the legislature fail to enact the plan. And on that basis, do you have any comment on the contents of the Dash 1 at this point?
I have looked at these several times. There's been kind of a working copy working around. These are fine. I mean, they'll work mechanically.
And as opposed to the current process?
Well, the current process works, too. And what this does is reflect the current process. Some of this is an attorney general's opinion. Assigning people to districts. Remember, in Oregon, until 1971, we did not have single-member districts. That's why you got this little announcement here about the county.
Right.
But in 71, Clay Marsh did the first single district. And that was ugly. And then we did 81-91. Okay. Having said that, one of the things about doing this is assigning somebody to the district. Remember, the representative 2 years and out, so you're never going to be assigned to anything. It's the senators at midterm, and it's the senators, more specifically, though, it's the senators at the end of their term. In 81, when we did this plan that the court accepted, we assigned senators, I mean, goodness, we had somebody from Southern Oregon representing Western Washington County. But that senator's term was over. Now, that senator could choose to go back and run for election or re-election in Jackson County, but in the meanwhile, nobody in Oregon was not represented. The inhabitation requirement in the Constitution begins and ends at the election. Once you're elected, it's the Wyatt case, it's a very famous case in Oregon, once you're elected, you don't have an inhabitation requirement. Your inhabitation requirement only occurs 1 year before your election. After that, you, for example, Mr. Chairman, can move to Salem.
There you go.
You have a hard time running for re-election, but nevertheless. But I'm just trying to make my point crystal clear. So we moved the senator, I can't remember the man's name, but we moved him to cover that district. And it lasted for, about a little over a year. But that district was represented by a person who was elected to the Oregon Senate, met all of the tests. And there's an attorney general's opinion on that. This makes it spells it out. But it's existing practice, policy, law, however you want to say it. And that's the way it's done. But it's not a science, guys. I'm sorry. It's not a science. It's an art.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Shelf?
I would like to thank you for your clarifying in my mind is how high it has to be to there. That personal theory does representation.
Yes, sir. And thus, under the rigors of any test you care to make, in as much as inhabitation is not a continuum. It's 1 year before and the day of election, the day after election, you're not required to be an inhabitant.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. We'll bring this back again, and we'll close the public hearing on HR 67. And seeing no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.
Sure, thank you.